part by a grant from RE/MAX Realty Associates, currently handling over 30% of the real estate sales transactions in Champaign County. 352-5700. Nobody sells more real estate than RE/MAX, and they encourage you to join them in supporting public broadcasting. Support for today's broadcast comes from the Prairie Ensemble, whose Heaven and Earth concert season begins Saturday, September 25th, with a program called Myths, featuring The Creation of the World by Darius Milhaud and Mozart's Jupiter Symphony. The concert starts at 7:30 p.m. at McKinley Presbyterian Church in Champaign. More information is available at 355-9077 or at prairieensemble.org.
Thanks to everyone who made the WILL Sweepstakes a win-win project. 11 lucky listeners won fabulous prizes, all donated by our generous sponsors, and people contributed more than $50,000 to help WILL continue to provide valuable programming and resources for the community. Thank you.
Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us this morning. According to the United Nations, the world's worst humanitarian crisis is now unfolding in Sudan's western region of Darfur. 1 million people reportedly have been forced from their homes, and it's estimated that tens of thousands of people have been killed. Last week, the Secretary of State for the United States, Colin Powell, said this country considered the killings in Darfur to be a case of genocide, and he urged the United Nations to take urgent action. This morning, in this hour of the program, we'll be talking about the Darfur crisis, and our guest for the program is Ali Dinar. He serves as the outreach coordinator for the African Studies Program at University of Pennsylvania and has had that position since 1994. He grew up in Sudan, in fact, in the Darfur region, is educated there in Sudan and here in the United States. He has a PhD from the Department of Folklore and Folklife at University of Pennsylvania and has now recently been doing a lot of presentations and interviews on the Darfur crisis. He also is the president-elect of the Sudan Studies Association. He's here visiting the campus. We'll be giving a talk at noon, and this will take place at the International Studies Building, 910 South 5th Street in Champaign in room 101. And I'm sure that anyone who is interested in attending should certainly feel welcome. On this program here, as always, people who would like to call in with questions are also welcome. We just ask people to try to be brief so that we can keep the program moving and get in as many different people as possible. But of course, anyone listening is welcome to be a part of the conversation. The number, if you're here in Champaign, Urbana, where we are, is 333-945. We do also have a toll-free line, so that if it would be a long-distance call, you may use that number, and we'll pay for the call. That's 800-222-9455. So at any point here, if you have questions you'd like to call in, you're welcome to do that. Well, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
There has been a long-running war going on in Sudan now, a decades-long war between the North and the South. And it is something that people have heard about, I'm sure, and has gotten coverage. But now here we're talking about something that is connected perhaps to that conflict, but is different, that we have been concentrating here now over the past period of months. In the most basic terms, from your perspective, what is going on now in Darfur?
What's going on in Darfur now is a tragedy by all it means of the word. And I think no one described it better than Secretary of State Colin Powell when he called it genocide. Although it's a long overdue statement, but we welcomed it, and that's exactly what's happening in Darfur for over a year now.
The analysis, I guess, that some people would put on it is something like this. After there has been this long-running conflict between the North and the South, and that both parties in that conflict came to the point where they felt that didn't make any sense, that they were trying to come to an accommodation. And as part of that accommodation, they came to agreements about how the resources of the country were going to be divided up, and that people living in Darfur looked at that and they said, what about us? We're being left out. This region has been neglected by the government. And as a way of getting the government's attention, some people in this region took up arms and started making war on the government. The government responded with their support of the Janjaweed militias. Is that the way that it is?
That could be part of the situation. There is a peace negotiation between the Sudan government and a rebel movement in the south called SPLM. And that was close to an end. That was a long civil war started in Sudan since independence in 1956. It came to a brief stop when a peace agreement was signed in 1971. And then resume of hostilities started in 1983 when that peace agreement was annulled by the Sudanese government. And that kind of civil war continued in Sudan until and immediately after the 9/11, and when a lot of countries, international community, have a lot of pressure on the Sudanese government. Sudanese government has bent to the will of international community and started seriously in negotiating a peace settlement with the main opposition group fighting it. And that was also a time when the problems in Darfur started. But making a link directly between what was going on between the Sudan government and the SPLM, and that triggered the Darfur situation, I think it may not explain the whole situation. The violence in Darfur was paralleled by the same kind of hostilities by the Sudanese government in its war in the south. There was a continuous cycle of violence, ethnic violence between different groups in the region. And so by the time when the military opposition declared itself in Darfur, that was not a surprise. It was not a surprise because there was a long string of incidents and a long history of Sudanese government, the current Sudanese government, siding some groups against another. Not necessarily like arming what is now being named Janjaweed, but like not providing enough security to the people in the region. Mm-hmm. And that's also aggravated by other problems, as you can, some people could know, from ecologic problems between residents of this region due to their lifestyle and economic practices between nomads and farmers, and encroachment of desert, which brought a lot of communities into contact and so on, and also due to influx of arms from Libya and from Chad, and lack of any political will from the government. The region itself was quite marginalized politically. It has no viable representation in the central government, and also no economic development scheme that will absorb a lot of able-bodied. Mm-hmm. So the situation in Darfur was extremely ripe by that time. And so when these two, one group, which is called SLA, and it stands for Sudan Liberation Army, when it started its presence, people in the region thought that this is just to protect the people from the government. And people, they never made a direct link between it at that time and Naivasha. And even when you look at the manifesto of the of this group and up to now, politically, it is not a fully fledged proposal, but that was the start of mm-hmm. the region in Darfur was very ripe. It was very tense due to history of neglect by the Sudanese government. Yeah. So that is just background of the situation, yeah. And not directly because there was peace agreement and wealth sharing between the Sudan government and the SPLM that push other groups in Sudan to take the arms so that they could have also their share from the cake.
Yeah. Well, I just not to belabor this point, but if that's we're not saying that that's a major factor, is that a factor? I mean, do we rule that out completely, or do we say, well, that's part of the mix, but it maybe is not the most important thing?
Yeah, it is part of it, but it is not the most important thing. Okay. Yeah, it's just not the most important.
Is it correct to view the fighting in Darfur as being fighting over control of resources?
I think, like, given the history of the region in terms of political and economic marginalization by the center in its dealing with it, the peripheries, and that the periphery including, say, Darfur, including southern Sudan, that is another situation. What we see now today, the situation now in the ground in Darfur, if you want to follow that kind of analysis of political marginalization and all this kind of neglect, doesn't necessarily will lead us to the cause of this genocide. Because this genocide is very simple. This is a government-sponsored act against a citizen. So we have to look at it from that perspective. And at the same time, also keep focusing on the problems of Darfur itself, which similar to the problems in southern Sudan. But we have to treat the tragedy in Darfur now in relation to the nature of the Sudanese government, which from the beginning it has a chance to stop this kind of violence. But it let it go, and what we have is the culmination of misguided policies from the Sudanese government.
The accusation has been leveled against the Sudanese government that it's directly supporting these what have been called Arab militias that have generically referred to as the Janjaweed, and the government of Sudan has said no, we are not directly supporting these groups. From your perspective, what do you think is the case?
I mean, from the perspective, is the government is lying. The government is not telling the truth. That was my contention before going to Darfur this summer. And after being there and have several interviews in tapes and so on, from people who were being displaced and they were living now in refugee camps inside Sudan. The stories which I collected and also collaborated by a lot of NGOs, it just tell the same pattern of the attack, government and government planes and government trucks and government troops. In collaboration with the Janjaweed, who were mainly Arab groups, wearing government insignia, not necessarily to the full uniform, you see. And that is all over and all over. And I don't see why people in Darfur would just lie. Mm-hmm. Why? What is the intention of not telling the truth? And but I'm sure, like the government, it doesn't want to be caught red-handed and to admit that it's supporting these Janjaweed and creating these militias.
You talked about the fact that there may well be parallels between the conditions and the grievances of people in the south in Sudan and in Darfur, in the sense that both regions have been marginalized, have been neglected, haven't had the opportunities for development that the North has. And so there are some experiences that these peoples share.
Yes.
What do you think is the motivation of the government of Sudan in supporting the Janjaweed? And if indeed genocide has been going on here. Genocide against the some of the people in the Darfur region. I mean, what is the government doing?
Yeah, I think like by answering this question and by raising that question, the link between Darfur and the peace negotiation in Naivasha or between the Sudan government and the SPLM, it will be clear, mm-hmm. or it will have its impact. But part of it is that, like, the government, the peace negotiation were going well in the south, and mainly it was in Kenya, in a place called Naivasha, that was where the negotiation was taking place. And one of the things the government, like, agreed to is that Islamic law will not be applied in the south, and that also there will be separation of troops. All troops in Darfur, in the south, will be out from the south, you mm-hmm. see. Mm-hmm. And that, after 6 years, there will be a referendum in southern Sudan to choose between joining, being part of Sudan, or secession. So all these were just new development and very important development to the future of the country. That was the time when this escalation, when these problems happened in Darfur, when this one group, the SLA, announced its presence, and the government looked at it and thought that it could just quell this movement. That was also a time when the people of Darfur and the local government, they convened a conference that was in February 2003, to reach consensus about all these problems which are enraging the region between the main players, the main groups, which some of the listeners know, Arab groups, people from the Fur, people from the Masalit, people from the Zagawa. And there was a committee which toured all these groups to see their grievances, and came and met with the rebels, and the rebels' demands were extremely simple. You can't believe someone who took to arm that they want things which I think are completely legitimate, even by the government official by that time. They want a development project in the region. They want to be recognized as a political force, as a political movement. That they want government to desist from arming militias, and so on. The government, instead of taking these things, by the admission of the president of the state, declared that only force would be used. Only force would be used. Mm. And the rebel reaction with that, it attacked the main city in Darfur, that is my city, it's called Darfashir, and it took it for half a day. It destroyed like 7 airplanes, fighters, and a lot of ammunition and so on, and then attacked more 2 places. And even by that time, a group of politicians from the region met with the rebels, made their demands. Still, their demands were very reasonable. But still, the government also insists. And then the group attacked another city, and that was the time when the Sudanese government turned to the Arab militias. Mm. So that is a new phase. Using of militias by the Sudanese government in Darfur is not new. The Sudanese army used militias fighting parallel with it in the south. And still these militias in the south, even today, they are still there and still like sending terror waves for the population. So that is the tactic which the Sudanese government just used a long time. It perfected that kind of policies of using militias. And that was why the government resort to arm instead of reaching a peaceful settlement that time, you see, instead of waiting all these years after all this destruction to go to Abuja in Nigeria to sit down with the same group, which at some point it described as bandits and armed robbers. I think that the government has its calculation by that time. Mm-hmm. I think the government was afraid from the army. The Sudanese army is the only viable threat to the National Islamic Front in Sudan. All government, all political parties are very weak. They constitute no threat. And I think by engaging the army in a war in another region, I think that would just deflect some kind of dissatisfaction instead of evacuating them from this house, you see, as a defeated army to go and come back to Khartoum or in other places in a victorious manner.
Mm. It would keep them busy.
Keep them busy, yes. Mm. Keep them busy. That is when. Another thing which also I think the government was afraid of is the composition of the Sudanese army itself. More than 60% of the troops, not the officers, are from Darfur, you see. And that is also because of lack of education, lack of any economic opportunities for people. So the only way for youth from Darfur to work and to earn living is joining the army. And to the extent that even like garrisons from places not from the region, they will come and recruit soldiers from Darfur. So creating such kind of a conflict using the army itself, that will lead to division, to the weakening of the army instead of one unit, weakening it also across ethnic lines and even within the Darfur itself, and especially if you created this new element, Arabs versus non-Arabs. Mm. That also could be one factor. Another factor also could be a political thing. This region, Darfur, is the main ground for one of main political parties in Sudan. It's called Umma Party. This is the traditional homeland for it. The National Islamic Front, the ruling party in Sudan now, is trying to create new alliances in the region for future. So by engaging the region in this war across ethnic lines, that means it created a conducive environment for establishing of new alliances. Those people, those in these alliances, those who will benefit from the system, from the government, will be in close contact with the government. So that means like at the end you will disrupt the base, the loyalty to the Umma Party and creating a new loyalty. So that is also another good thing for that. Another factor which you could also entertain is that Darfur is, in Sudan, oil now is the main export. By second to oil is livestock. And Darfur is very rich in livestock. And livestock is mainly owned by Arab groups. So this war, indirectly, since you are targeting non-Arab groups, you are creating a conducive environment also to benefit Arab groups, and especially if the issue now is land. Having access to more land, more grazing lands in the region, that will benefit these groups. Not necessarily they were being happy or directly involved in this, all of them, but they will be the beneficiary of any future settlement. That is also could be like one of the issues that is why this government is making this. Another thing also which we could just see that like part of it also maybe for the government making revenge because the SLA, it inflicted a lot of heavy losses on the Sudanese government. This is something they don't talk about it, but a lot of army troops, they were being killed. And in a country like Sudan, which one day in just like less than half an hour lost like most of it is military power in Darfur. These were, they bombed planes on the tarmac, just like sitting there with all their ammunition, they bombed them. I think that is not something the government or the military will just take it easy. And I think part of that frustration and need to revenge. Those of you who are listening to, for example, like a BBC, at some point it broadcasted a conversation between an army pilot, Sudanese army pilot, and a ground officer. The army pilot is saying that to the one in the ground, go and burn all these villages. Go and kill them so that no one will come back and destroy wells and all this. All this is like still on a website, a real conversation between these officers. And even using a phrase which saying that this is, and take whatever possessions you have as a war booty. And using a specific phrase in Islamic discourse called ghanima, which you could only use it if you are fighting an infidel or a non-Muslim. So for some people, they were just using that as if these were not Muslim, but they were Muslims. But you have to look beyond that. What does that mean? And when I look beyond that, deep in, I could just see some element of racism in that being used, because that is the use of jihad by the Sudanese government. That was a term which was used in the fight, in fighting the southerners, southern Sudanese, like mostly Christians and people who believe in traditional religions. So in that, up to now, if you have access to Sudanese TV, you could just still, the Sudanese government broadcast such kind of programs advocating jihad and martyrs, people who were being killed in this house. Mm-hmm. This is the same government which, unfortunately, a lot of people think that it will come to its senses. I think we will make a big mistake in believing that this government will do something good for its citizens. Yeah. And I think what happened now in Darfur is just like a case in point that the government is not trusted. You can't trust it.
Yeah. And just again, just to I have a couple calls here, and I promise we'll get right to these people. But just to underscore, just to make sure that it's clear, people understand what you have said here, particularly about this, the religious dimension here, is that the rebels, the Janjaweed, the government, they are all Muslims. Everyone in this. So it's not like the North and South conflict where you have Muslims in the North and Christians and animists in the South. In this particular case, they're all Muslim.
Yes.
Yes. Well, let me reintroduce our guest for this part of Focus 580. We're speaking with Dr. Ali Dinar. He's Outreach Director for the African Studies Program at University of Pennsylvania, and is Sudanese himself, and has recently been doing a lot of interviews and presentations on the crisis in Darfur. He's here visiting the campus. We'll be giving a talk at noon today at the International Studies Building. So if you're interested in hearing more of what he has to say, anybody here around Champaign-Urbana should stop by, feel welcome. Questions are welcome here too, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. We have a Chicago caller to start out with on our line number 4. Hello.
Hi. What's very confusing to me is the use of the term Arab, because that's an ethnicity. And so what I'm trying to understand are the Janjaweed ethnic Sudanese, whose ethnicity is Arabic or Arabs, or are they Yemeni, Omani, Saudis, Arabs from outside of the country, not Sudanese, who are there? And if they are ethnic Sudanese, then perhaps maybe what I need to understand as an American is, are there rank or status divisions within Sudanese society based on ethnic divisions that were perhaps acerbated during the colonial period, did the British use the Muslims who had some education as administrative units and therefore they had power, as opposed to people who did not, or who were not is Muslims and therefore perhaps were not educated? I'm just finding it very difficult when people say Arab, because I don't know if we're talking about ethnic Sudanese, or if you're talking about extra nationals such as Yemenis or Omanis who have come in to fight in the militia.
Yeah, that is a very good question, and I think you will find in a lot of news reports this description of the war in Sudan as Arab groups fighting Africans.
Yes.
If you visit Sudan now, it is very hard for you to tell who is an Arab and who is non-Arab.
Right.
And but that is so it is, you could just say it is a cultural term. This is how people, some people in Sudan, they just identify themselves. Race has nothing to do with that. Color has nothing to do with that. But this is how people, they just view themselves. This is their perception of themselves as Arabs or as non-Arabs.
Okay, and that's what you need to explain to us as Westerners, because that was my confusion, because I had never seen a quote-unquote Arab or black Sudanese. They, as you say, they, and I could not understand who these Arabs were. And my assumption was that they were from other Arab countries coming in. So the Janjaweed are Sudanese nationals.
They are Sudanese nationals, but who describe themselves as Arab. They identify themselves as Arabs. Not only that, in Sudan, a lot of people, they have lineages. They people claim that they were people. They will give you all their grandfathers they came from. A lot of people, they will claim either coming from Arabia, and not only that, but there are some groups in Sudan who claim coming from descendants of the Prophet, you see. So this is not like just an individual person, but like a whole group. This is how ethnicity just being constructed in Sudan.
So it's like a status to be Arab Sudanese? Is it a question of a ranking or status within the society, if you can make these claims?
You see, that is something, it is a bit complex. Mm-hmm. For people, for example, in Sudan, because Islam or religion has a very important part in that. So if you look at the early Islamic states in Sudan, the ones in Darfur or the one in another part of Sudan in the eastern part called Sennar, the royal families, they always claim that they have a claim, although they were indigenous Africans, but they claim that the royal family, the founder of the royal family, came from Arabia, or that he has something, has a relation with the Prophet. Mm-hmm. This has its significance in a place in which people, they just want to distinguish themselves from their surroundings. Mm-hmm. But at the same time also, in the daily discourse, people, when someone calls you, you are just an Arab, that means you are just someone who is ignorant or someone who is uncivilized. So that is also in the same Sudanese context. In the context of this war in Darfur, why people were saying that or making this reference to Arabs or non-Arabs, talking to victims there and so on, that is how this war is conducted. Those groups who claim that they were Arabs, it doesn't matter whether they were red or black or green in color, but those who, this is a specific group who claim that they were Arabs, the government allied itself with it, and there is an ideological connection in that case. And these groups, they were targeting, they would ask, they would just come to a village and they would ask you if you are non-Arab, you will be attacked. And that is how some villages or part of villages which were being inhabited by Arabs, they were saved. So that is the conduct of the war in Darfur. But at the same time also, yes, people have to make connection. When people talking about Sudan and people making reference to Arabs or non-Arabs, we have to think about them in the context of Sudanese ethnic complexity and Sudanese ethnic heritage.
Okay, so this is a war among all Sudanese nationals. We are not talking about extra nationals coming in as mercenaries.
No one coming from outside.
Okay.
Yes.
All right.
But the government is using this thing.
Mm-hmm.
The government, when the international community now is backing the African Union effort in making ceasefire, in providing security for the Sudanese, when the influx of a lot of NGOs and relief organizations now in Darfur working to help the people, what the Sudanese government is now doing is saying that is making connection, making a lot of appeals to the Arab countries, to Islamic countries, that it is under threat, that it is whole Islamic orientation and Arabism in Sudan is under threat, and that people have to come and help the Sudan. So that is the what is coming out from the Sudan now, encountering attempts of saving its own citizens, which it inflicted a lot of atrocities against it.
Okay, then my next question is, this seems to be another resource war, and I don't know if that's true or not, but what I'd like you to be able to do is that, can you put this in the context of what's been happening for the last two decades or more in Africa, across the continent, these seemingly coups, insurrections, low-intensity warfare, that all seems to be related when you dig deep enough to wars over resources and lots of outside funding, if not by foreign governments, by foreign corporations with budgets the size of countries, to get the basic resources.
Yeah, but I think like what is happening now in Darfur, this real tragedy which we were just talking about and everyone is just talking about, I don't think this is like a war of resources. Mm-hmm. I think this is very simple. This is a government-sponsored killing of its citizens for its own policies of being into power.
But the thing that always bothers me is that when all the accounts that I hear, there's a real intent to move people off their land, which is usually the first step into taking over the land, is to get the population out.
Yeah, but that could be like in a place like in the southern part of Sudan, in which oil was found, and there was very documented cases of government attacking villages which were close to all these pipelines and all these exploration sites. Mm-hmm. That is different. What is happening now in Darfur now these days, the government is trying hard, is spending a lot of money as bribes to people to go back to their lands. So this is a different situation. Although in the beginning, when this war flared, people thinking that okay, this is an attempt from the government to redistribution of land, of giving Arab groups more land and so on. Now the government is just doing the opposite. It prays, you see, that people could just go back to their land.
Okay. Well, thank you, because I find the situation very confusing. I find the reporting on it by Americans very confusing. And from what you've just said, it is a lot more complex and a lot different than what we see given on the news. So I appreciate you being here today.
All right. Thank you
very
much.
Thanks for the call. Let's go to Champaign County. We have another caller right here, line number one. Hello.
Yes, excellent colloquy. The only thing I have in to critique is the interchangeability of ethnicity and nationality, so that we talk about them being Sudanese ethnics, but they're actually Sudanese nationals, and it's the whole thing. I don't think that you addressed the colonial question so much as well. There are other states in Africa that have this division of Arab in the north and mostly Africans in the south, so obviously some of these countries are even much more diverse than that. But something, if you would, a little more explicitly on the direct question the previous caller asked was, did the British, when they were ruling Sudan, use the Arabs as sort of the overlords? I guess you did sort of point at that. I did have two other questions, but that was provoked by this repartee.
Yeah, I mean, that is also... that is not something obvious. When the British, they just left. Before they left, there was a process of Sudanization of jobs, which were being taken by the British. And out of 600 jobs, just 3 jobs went to people from the South, and none went to any person from the Darfur. So that just explained that those who inherited the colonial rule in Sudan, they were people from riverine Sudan. And I think, like, we have also, that is also part of the Sudanese ethnic complexity, is that, like, people of riverine Sudan, they refer to themselves, they identify themselves, they have specific names. They don't call them, when you say Arabs, that means mainly nomads. And those Arabs in Sudanese context, nomads, Arab nomads could be found in Darfur, could be found in Kordofan, could be found in the Blue Nile. But those who inherited the colonial legacy in Sudan, those were people from the northern Sudan who were from groups called Jaaliyin or Shaygiya or Tanagla. Most of them adhere to as descendants of the Prophet, but those groups also, they just look down on Arab groups who were just nomads from Darfur or from Kordofan.
This sort of sets the stage for my question that provoked my call, which was, you mentioned the environmental aspect. I've heard the story about how the Sahara is expanding by 3 kilometers, 4 kilometers a year or something. But on the BBC, and they're maybe watching it closely because they're post-colonial, a person described that there's also something going on with the timing, that there used to be sort of a synergy between the nomads who would come in with their animals at the right time. It would actually fertilize the land. It wouldn't compete with the farmers. The farmers are actually benefiting from it. And then, but somehow something has happened. Such the timing is different, and it is a competition over resources at a very low level. But while you were talking, it made me think of the oil companies having cut the deal in the South. That is it too Machiavellian to think that someone might be instigating this to sort of slow down the oil deal in the South? There are definitely accusations that the oil companies' deals in the South caused some inattention from the corporations and the governments of the North because they didn't want to upset the deal. Is that too complicated? Would you like to comment on that, please?
Yeah, I just hear all these conspiracies, all these things all over. But for me, they are not yet substantiated, because I think, like, at some point, it just deflect me from focusing on exactly what is happening now in the ground in Darfur. Because by the same token, also there is some talk about oil being found in Darfur, and that this kind of war waged by the government is also for future displacement, for future investment in the region. But that is something which is just flying around. And I think, like, what I want the international community and people to focus more on, the role of the Sudanese government of what is happening now. All the reasons, all other issues which connected to the war in Darfur, people could just still entertain it, and just even they could just go beyond that. For example, what the interest of the U.S. and the interest of France in this war, to what extent this war in Darfur could also destabilize the peace in the region, in Central Africa, in Central African Republic, in Chad, and so on. To what extent this also could influence the fight of the U.S. War against terrorism. To what extent this could also have linkages with oil investment in Chad. The U.S. Is investing there. And what about the role of France? France now is not going with Secretary Powell in describing what is happening in Darfur as a genocide. The same also with the Chinese. What about the fight against terrorism by the American forces now training some African units in combating terrorist acts? Chad was also part of that. So I think all these issues people could just talk about, you see. They are all interconnected. But at the same time also, if we just focus on that, we will not doing any good. We were not saving the lives of people who were now being affected. There were more than almost 2 million people being displaced in Darfur. What about all these villages being burned? What about people who lost everything? They lost nothing. They were nothing. Are we going just to let them in camps and provide them with food? And as it is now, pray to God that like next year they will harvest their crops. What is the Sudanese government role in compensating these people, since it is also involved in this? When we're talking about genocide, what is the legal and moral ramification of that? I think that is what we need also to focus on, at the same time also when we explore other issues relating to the war in Darfur.
We're coming to the point here where you have just about 5 minutes left. And I would like you to talk a little bit about what you see as the potential for intervention by the United States, by Europe, by other African countries, by whoever. As we know, I think people who follow Sudan would know that this conflict had been brewing for some time, but it probably didn't really catch the attention of people outside of Africa until maybe earlier this year. And now, after all these many months, finally we're starting to get around to actually using a word like genocide, which you would think would prompt the United States, the United Nations, the European countries to want to somehow to get involved. So what do you think outside parties can do to try to mediate this conflict and stop the violence? And I would say there are large numbers of refugees that are now actually outside the country in Chad. And we have a number of serious problems here, a real serious crisis in this region. Yeah. What can outsiders do?
Yeah, I think like what this war, just from my visit there, there is a huge distrust from the people against their government. People were very suspicious about the intention, because this is the same group, whether it is the group, whether it's the Sudanese army or whether it is the Janjaweed. These are the people who were inflicted all these tragic acts on them. So people were just very disgusted. People never trust the Sudanese government in protecting them. And that is the general sentiment. Because what the Sudanese government is now doing, it used that excuse or that call, which is a genuine call by the international community, for the Sudanese government to provide protection for its citizens. What it is now doing is that it is recruiting Janjaweed, the same Janjaweed, absorbing them in the army, absorbing them in the police, and asking them to go and protect people. So this is the situation now in Darfur. Even with all these calls for providing security for the people and so on, I look at it, and other people also look at it, as this is a harassing force. This is not a force that will really bring in peace. And that also goes in hand, because the Sudanese government up to now, in its discourse, in its mass-controlled media, it is in a state of denial. It is denying that this thing it exists, you see. Even the foreign minister saying that what happened in Darfur, it is not a genocide, only 5 people killed. And so for him, like 5 people killed, that is not... So when he look at genocide in terms of numbers, not in terms of acts and so on. So as long as the Sudanese government is not willing to come in reality with its role in that. I think there is an obligation for the international community to provide whatever kind of protection to the Sudanese, to the people in Darfur. And I think like what is happening now is that there is more emphasis now in supporting the African Union force. There is a force already in Darfur of peace monitors. And the intention is that is to increase the numbers of these peace monitors to be also to protect the civilians, you see. Because the force now is just protecting the peace monitors. And I think what the people of Darfur now need, since the government is not willing to disarm the Janjaweed, to care from it is all policies, I think the international community at least has a responsibility of providing that kind of protection. Mm-hmm. And I think this is a moral obligation and a long-term investment for peace in Darfur, which means also peace in the region and peace for the world.
Well, there we will have to stop. For people who are in and around Champaign-Urbana who would like to hear more from our guest on this subject, our guest, Dr. Ali Dinar, will be speaking in the at the International Studies Building at noon today. That's 910 South 5th in Champaign, room 101, continuing to have more to say about the conflict in Darfur. He is the Outreach Director for the African Studies Program at University of Pennsylvania and visiting here on the campus. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Our program here, Focus 580, is made possible in part with support from the Art Mart in the Lincoln Square Mall, Urbana. The Art Mart is pleased to support public radio in East Central Illinois. The broadcast is also made possible with support from Christie Clinic, with offices in Champaign, Urbana, Rantoul, and Mahomet, providing quality health care to the residents of Central Illinois. Coming up a little bit later today, as part of the Afternoon Magazine, we'll explore American popular music. Celeste Quinn will be talking with writer Nadine Cahotas, who's authored a book about the great American singer Dinah Washington. She was born Ruth Lee Johnson in 1924. She was just 39 when she died in 1963. Hard to believe when you listen to her voice and consider the depth and breadth of her recordings. Some exploration of the life of Dinah Washington with the author of the book Queen, The Life and Music of Dinah Washington. That's coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine. We'll have more Focus 580 in a little bit. We'll have news from National Public Radio first, though. We'll have an update on the markets. Stay tuned.
The Carl Center for Rural Health and Farm Safety is proud to underwrite agricultural programming on WILL. The center helps residents of rural communities with education and training in farm safety. For more information, call 217-383-4606.
And good morning. With this update on the markets at 10:59, I'm Jay Pierce. Wheat up just a bit on the Board of Trade as fund short covering has triggered that.